Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention now to growing and using perennial food crops. And we've got a couple of guests from the Savannah Institute. Jacob Grace, the Communication Project Manager, and Lily Hislop, the black currant and elderberry breeder for the Savannah Institute. Jacob has a master's degrees in two areas, one agroecology and the other, actually from my home academic department, life sciences communication at the UW-Madison. Jacob, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be back, Larry.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. Lily has a PhD from UW-Madison in plant breeding and in plant genetics. She's worked with a variety of species, including things like sweet corn, pumpkin, miscanthus, teosinte, lily, a lot of things. And I'm going to be talking with you about some of those things, but welcome to the show again. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Larry. Happy to be here.
So as we talk with our guests, I hope you join in. What would you like to know about adding perennial fruit crops to your landscape, your garden? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jacob, first, refresh us on what the Savannah Institute does and maybe how it got started and what's going on with it.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the Savannah Institute is a nonprofit organization. We're about 10 years old now. And we do most of our work is related to agroforestry, which I'm sure we'll talk about more. So that's anything involving trees or woody plants on farms. And it's a type of perennial agriculture, which is farming with perennial plants. We'll be talking a lot more about that too. But we're a relatively young organization, and a lot of our work is kind of in the southern Wisconsin and north central Illinois area. We're now managing some demonstration farms near Spring Green, Wisconsin, also kind of near central Illinois. And we're really trying to do kind of the research and development and demonstration to figure out what it takes to grow these perennial tree crops here in the Midwest, and to do so in a way that is profitable for farmers and can also have benefits for the land and the soil and water quality and some of these other things we really care about in this part of the country.
Yeah. What are the crops that you grow at the Institute?
Yeah, we grow a lot of different types of tree crops, but some of the ones that we're really interested in are crops that can serve multiple purposes. So these are things that you can raise for the fruits and the nuts off the trees themselves, but that they can also do other things like provide wildlife habitat, provide windbreaks, provide shelter for livestock. So we're really interested in some of these multi-purpose crops, and some of the ones that we've kind of zeroed in on a little bit are nut trees like chestnuts and hazelnuts. We're interested in some berry crops like black currants and elderberries, which is Lily's specialty. And then we're interested in persimmons, which is a really nutritious and delicious fruit that can grow here in the Midwest. And a number of other crops that we're working with too, but those are some of kind of the ones we talk about the most, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Lily, how'd you get interested in this business of perennial growing and farming?
For a long time, I love food. I'm a big food fan, a big flavor fan, and I love working with plants and sciences. And to find this intersection of I can focus on flavor while working with plants and having a combination of inside-outside work and seeing large-scale results happening is really rewarding. So to find a job that allows me to do that, especially in a nonprofit where I can be working on like restorative agriculture, it's just a dream come true.
Oh, it sure sounds like it when I hear you talk. And, you know, you've got this interesting background. I think I mentioned in the introduction, you've worked with sweet corn and pumpkin, miscanthus and teosinte. Miscanthus, teosinte are probably two that may be less well-known to our gardening community. Let's talk miscanthus. It's a kind of a high-yield perennial grass, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I started in undergrad looking at biological sciences and wanting to do plant sciences in general. So my miscanthus work was in my undergrad, and I was looking at genes that control flowering time in miscanthus. And miscanthus in this context is a grass that we grow for biofuels. It's a quick growing perennial grass that produces a lot of biomass. And then I did some work looking at tropical seeds and how tropical seeds interact with fungi in like collaborative, mutualistic ways. I did some research on pumpkins and pumpkin diseases. Specifically, there's a bacteria called Xanthomonas cucurbitae that makes pumpkins rot, and it's just the smelliest job. It was interesting, but it was so smelly.
Yeah, had to take a bath and wash the clothes when you got done with that.
Oh my God, you're getting the bacterial cultures trying to pick it up. Oh, and then you're just injecting it into leaves. And then my PhD work was on sweet corn, specifically on the sugars and carbohydrates on sweet corn, and looking for genetic markers that align with different levels of sweetnesses. And I had a little bitty side project trying to make a perennial sweet corn. And sweet corn is not perennial, neither is regular corn, right? We lost that when we domesticated sweet corn. So teosinte is the ancestor that corn was domesticated from. So trying to make a perennial sweet corn, I was crossing back to teosinte and getting those perennial genes back into the corn. And luckily at the Savannah Institute, I can have that be a teeny part of my job, a little bit, as a fun side project.
Well, you know, and I, if you look at the corn, that corn itself, that teosinte, it's kind of, it's pretty cool looking. The kernels, if I'm not mistaken, they're a harder kernel. I mean, they were used, have been used as a food source, certainly.
The domestication occurred about 8,000 years in the Balsa River Valley of Mexico, and the archaeological evidence suggests that they were using teosinte as a food source, primarily as a popped corn.
It's popcorn.
They're tiny and they're hard, and they are covered in this really hard seed coat that kind of looks like puppy teeth or like tiny hooves. But if you throw them in a fire, they can pop. And so that's how they started eating them in the first place.
Oh, well, now you, well, they ground them, I think, too. And you could boil them, I imagine, too.
Yeah, and if you really spend a lot of time grinding, you can get through that seed coat.
Yeah, you want some sort of electric grinder for that, maybe. I don't know. Jacob, why do farms need to be more resilient?
Well, that's a big question, and there are a lot of reasons for that. But when we talk about agroforestry and talk about some of these crops that Lily is working with, we kind of think of agroforestry as this thing that can be a solution to a lot of different challenges at once. So farmers are dealing with a lot of different challenges in our area, with profitability and farm viability being a big one, but also just dealing with things like flooding events, less predictable weather, if, you know, we're the dairy state and a lot of farmers are trying to find ways to increase milk production, increase animal comfort so that they can have better milk production. And it's fun for me working for the Savannah Institute to hear the different reasons that people come to us interested in agroforestry. And there are a lot of different reasons that people kind of find us and find our work. And it can be everything from wanting a new crop that might be a new source of income, working with one of these up and coming crops, to maybe they have a system that they're very happy with, but they have one problem they're trying to solve, like trying to reduce their wind erosion or trying to slow down the water that's flowing off their land, trying to provide more comfort for their livestock, something like that. So you know, we say a lot that agroforestry can look a different way on every single farm. It's very flexible. It can look a lot of different ways. It's going to look different in Wisconsin than it would in Iowa or in Illinois. And I think that's a good thing, is that it can really be adapted to whatever someone's needs are and what their challenges might be.
Yeah. And as we move along, I'm thinking about home gardeners now, and a lot of the things that you're talking about, home gardeners could have on their own property as well.
That's exactly right. And one of the things that we were talking about as we were getting ready for this is that I know people ask about perennial crops or agroforestry crops that they can grow in their backyard as opposed to growing on a farm. And I think that some of the crops that Lily works with, like these elderberries and black currants, some of these bushier berry crops are really a good fit for home gardening.
And Lily McCormick just revealed that the black currant is its flavor of the year.
Oh, it's so exciting.
Yeah, how's that going to affect your work?
Oh, I'm stoked about it. So
you've hit the big time, Lily.
I have. It's what a great stroke of luck. We have not worked with McCormick in any capacity. We're hoping to work with them this year, but this is a surprise to us, too. So black currant is a really unfamiliar flavor in the United States. The primary reason for that is we had a federal ban against all black currants and their larger genus Ribes for 55 years in the United States, starting from 1911 to 1966. And that's because they are a host for a fungus that is a little inconvenient for currant plants, but kills pine trees. It's called white pine blister rust. And during the when this disease first was brought to the U.S., pine was the big industry in the Northeast. They had reforested basically all of New England with white pines because it was really cheap, and there weren't many tariffs on the importation of seedlings. And so the government chose to focus on the pine investment and get rid of the black currant plants. And they did that by employing war internees and the Civilian Conservation Corps and high schoolers, and they just sent tens of thousands of people out into the forests of the United States to get rid of all the Ribes plants they could find. And that includes both black currant, which is it's a European variety, it's a European species, and that includes all the native varieties. We have maybe 27 species of Ribes plants native to the North American region. And so around that time was also when we were like inventing mass-produced candies and flavors and jellos and sodas. And the flavors that they were developing at that time were what they had available in terms of ingredient. So black currant wasn't around as an ingredient. And so we just missed the boat on having it enter our like flavor lexicon as far as Americans go. So for example, in Skittles, the green Skittle is lime or green apple or whatever, and the yellow Skittle is lemon. And in America, the purple Skittle is grape. And in the UK, the purple Skittle is black currant, right? So like other places have a familiarity with this flavor and we don't. So I'm so excited for Americans to like have this prompting of, what is this plant? I've never heard of it. How do I try and eat it? And what does it taste like?
You know, I don't know what you think about the taste. Somebody said, well, it tastes to me like a strong blackberry mixed with a dark grape.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I would describe it as a blackberry and pine. It has a like deep berry flavor and also a little bit of a like sulfuric, interesting component that really adds a depth to it. I think it's absolutely the best jam you can get.
Yeah, I think so. Cheryl in Bessemer, Michigan has something to add right to this conversation here. Let's go there. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Larry. It's me calling about wine again. My boyfriend, we moved all these blackcurrant plants from this farm, and they went nuts in my backyard. And my boyfriend makes the best wine out of it. Well, he makes all kinds of wine. He makes the best wine out of it, and it'll kick your butt, believe me. It would. I'll tell you what, I'm tempted to get a little still and make it into a brandy. It is so good. But you have to be careful. because it comes out a lot stronger.
That sounds delicious.
Blackcurrant wine. There, well, you can start experimenting with that, Lily.
Absolutely. I do cassis, and it's one of the ways that I compare different cultivars of the black currants I'm breeding is to make it into a creme de cassis, which is, you know, infused vodka, basically.
How does, black currants certainly grow well here in Wisconsin. If, you know, Cheryl's growing them in Bessemer, Michigan, they ought to work well here for anybody who wanted to put some in their backyard.
Yeah, they do really well. They are mainly limited by heat, not by cold. They can get as cold as you like, basically, negative 50 Fahrenheit. They just don't like being above 100 for very long if you can avoid it. So they do really well in full sun. They do well in partial shade, and especially if you're looking at red currants, which is a different species, but also a very similar bush architecture. Those almost yield better in the shade because they're a forest crop and they're a forest plant. They need a pretty normal pH between like 5 and 7 or 8. They're pretty tolerant in that. They don't super mind having wet feet. They'd rather not, but...
They'd rather not. But, all right, so you're telling me practically, well, not everywhere in Wisconsin, but in a good share of Wisconsin, you could grow them. That'd be fun to have.
Yeah.
I mean, could you have access? The thing is, and Jacob, you probably know this, the access to the plants might be an issue.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And that's part of why our organization exists, is to try to help scale up some of these crops that we're working with. So Lily's involved in that work. We're doing some of that work on our farms. And we also have a kind of a sister organization called Canopy Farm Management, which is has a nursery business. So that's not a nonprofit. That's a nursery business that is trying to make some of these crops available for people. And Lily's been working to get some of the blackcurrant varieties that she works with out into other nurseries across the state as well.
Yeah. So we have two blackcurrant varieties that we have released to retail nurseries this year. They're called Savannah Zing and Savannah Zap. They're both really delicious. They're both high yielding plants that work great in a home garden. And you can get those from Canopy Nursery. And we have another number of retail nurseries, such as One Green World, that are going to start stocking it. And I'm trying to get it into more nurseries as well. So if you have a home nursery or a nearby place that sells bush plants and you want them to stock Savannah Zing and Savannah Zap, have them email me.
Yeah, you're ready and willing to help out there with that. I'm thinking it'd be fun to have, not only is this, I mean, for farms, it could be wonderful. For the home gardener, too, you're looking at, I mean, what's a plant going to produce? Maybe 10 pounds? I don't know. I have no idea.
It depends on how close you plant them together. But a plant, a black currant plant, you can get between 2 pounds and 10 pounds of fruit per bush. If you give it more space, it'll produce more fruit. If you prune it well, it'll produce more fruit. If you give it the fertilizer it needs, it'll produce more.
And I'm thinking from a sales standpoint or just from your own home use, I mean, black currants are, if I'm not mistaken, very high in vitamin C. They contain... Do they contain antioxidants as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My personal saying is that the healthiest berry for you is the one you're willing to eat. And if you find a blackcurrant variety you like, then they're delicious and they're great for you.
Karen in Kewaunee has something. Let's go there. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I'm glad to talk to you. Very interesting program. I have been planting a lot of these bushes for well over 30 years. I have over 50 of them, from aronia, goji berries, black, red currants, yasta berries, all of it. I plant all of these in tires, So I can go around them with the weed whacker or lawnmower without injuring the plants. And I also pack rabbit manure inside the tires, so kind of as a mulch. But also domesticated rabbit manure will repel wild rabbits from chewing on these plants in winter. A comment about the black currants, they are very good for diabetics. I don't know if you're aware of that. The leaves make fantastic tea, and it is a taste that you have to acquire. I pick these. I put them in bags in the freezer. They go in my yogurt, my smoothies, my oatmeal in the morning. But all of these berries are very good for you. But just a comment I wanted to make. Also, when I make sweet breads, I substitute like black currants and red currants for cranberries. They make the most delicious sweet breads, especially around the holidays.
Oh, Karen, what a salesperson. You need about another million people just like her here in the state.
Yeah, I learned some things there.
Well, you always learn something here on Garden Talk.
That's true.
Two guests for you today, Jacob Grace and Lily Hislop. They are both with the Savannah Institute, and we're talking with them today. It's great to have them with us. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Big thanks to everybody who donated during our year-end member drive. Support from people like Renee in Watertown or Pat in Milwaukee have really helped make our service possible. If you missed the drive, still time to join in with your gift at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Right now, we're talking with Jacob Grace and also with Lily Hislop, both with the Savannah Institute. And we're taking a look at the latest of their work on growing perennial foods. And we've got tree crops, and plants, bush plants. We've been talking a lot about black currants. But others as well, and glad to have you listening in, and certainly feel free to join in. You know, we haven't mentioned the nuts. We're nuts. Nutty myself, but the nut crops, the ones that you're studying, Jacob, are, just to get that into the mix here.
Yeah, thanks for bringing those back. Two of the ones we talk a lot about are chestnuts and hazelnuts. Those are both nut crops that grow pretty well in our part of the world. And sometimes we describe these as corn on trees and soybeans on trees. So chestnuts are these kind of similar to corn in some ways. They're very starchy and sweet, and are, as some of our farmers say, everything likes to eat chestnuts. Humans, deer, raccoons, anything that can find a chestnut will eat it. They're just really delicious, and they can be added to a lot of things, kind of as you would use some of these things like corn. And then hazelnuts are a very oil-rich crop, and so people might be familiar with hazelnut oil, and it can kind of serve some of the same purposes in that regard, too. We're excited about hazelnuts because they can be grown in a bit more of a shrub form that we're starting to harvest them with machines, which is kind of one of the big bottlenecks to a lot of these crops, is going from harvesting them by hand to being able to harvest them more efficiently with machinery. So those are two that we're looking at a lot. And something I was thinking about during the break with the last caller who was talking about black currants, but also some of these other berry crops like elderberries or like aronia berries. It reminded me of something that Lily told me actually when I was interviewing her for our podcast that we produce from the Savannah Institute. And Lily was saying that we're used to being able to eat berries raw. And so a lot of our most common berries, like strawberries and blueberries, you get them at the store and you just pop them right in your mouth. And some of these berries that we're working with, like black currants or aronia berries, They're really healthy. They're really nutritious, but eating them raw is not necessarily giving them their opportunity to shine. So it was nice to hear from the first caller who's doing some making the blackcurrant wine. I know Lily's working with different things you can do with these berries, but that was kind of a something that I learned from Lily, is that if you really want to make the most of some of these berry crops, you might want to make them into jam or jelly or something other than just eating them raw, because that's what we're used to, but that's not necessarily when they're at their best.
I'm not a big fan of persimmons raw.
Right. You got to be careful. If you get a good persimmon, it's delicious. But if you get it too early, it's like eating a cotton ball. Yeah.
Well, we got all of our lines are filled. Dwayne in River Falls, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dwayne.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I've planted a few three blackcurrant bushes a couple years ago, and I've been trying over the last several years to turn my landscape into edible, urban, type of thing.
Yeah.
But it's and the first year I got like maybe a pint of berries. Now this last year I got enough for a batch of jam and a batch of cassis. I'm hoping next year I get a batch of wine out of it. But I do have another question about the nut trees. How good is a butternut for an urban tree?
Ooh, how good is a butternut for an urban tree? That's a great question. I'm not super familiar with butternuts. They are sure tasty, though. My gut is to try it and see if it fails, it fails. But I don't think I've seen one in an urban environment before.
Well,
right. Yeah. I would also wonder, it might vary from tree to tree. I have pretty limited knowledge with butternuts, but I'm sure we have people on our staff who are the wheels are turning and they're wondering that themselves. So I wish they were here on the call. I hope you try it and maybe something good will come out of it.
You know, I was thinking about, we used to have all kinds of chestnut trees in this country, and we kind of lost a big chunk of them years back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Chestnut water or something.
Yeah.
The American. Oh, you want to take it, Jacob?
You did a great job talking about the history of black currants. Do you want to talk about chestnuts too? Because a lot of these crops have very interesting histories of how they were here, and we kind of knew how to use them and knew what to do with them, and then something happened and they became less common. And that's definitely true for chestnuts.
One of the big problems with perennial agriculture, and one of the, like, the thing that keeps me in a job, is that trees don't know how to run. And so therefore diseases can really take them out. So the American chestnut was decimated by the chestnut blight. And that is a fungal disease that basically killed all these chestnuts that were native to the Americas. And it's a fungus that causes them to die back all the way to the ground, and then their root structures can survive, some of them, and they'll re-sprout, but it's really detrimental to nut production. So we don't have the American chestnuts anymore, really. There is efforts to bring them back through genetic engineering and breeding, and at the Savannah Institute, we are focusing primarily on Chinese chestnuts, which fills a similar ecological niche, but is resistant to the blight. So with this, you can get a successful berry crop. And when we're trying to get farmers to be able to grow stuff that will provide them livelihood, we are banking more on the side of things that have the resistance already built in, as opposed to trying to build it up from scratch through breeding. Yeah. But Chinese chestnuts are delicious. And it's so funny, they're hypothetically not as cold hardy as American chestnuts. And so we planted tens of thousands out in our farm in Spring Green, Wisconsin, to narrow down which ones were cold tolerant enough to survive in Wisconsin. And we planted them really tight, expecting like half of them to die. And unfortunately, the vast majority have survived.
So now you're going to have to
figure out what to do with them.
Yeah. Now you're going to have to move them.
It's great for a grower in Wisconsin, and that's not a lot of good science for us. So.
Oh, boy. Steve in Two Harbors. I think we're going back to currants with Steve. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi. How are you guys today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
I'm wondering if black currants would if I planted them in like canvas bags, if I could move them. I've got a move coming up within a year, and but I still want to plant the black currants. So I'm wondering if all those bags you can buy, that you put dirt in, and would that work on a black currant or not?
Yeah, absolutely. A black currant is going to really start producing, like, it's not going to fruit too much on first year wood, but if you plant something in a canvas bag and it's living there for a couple years, that's going to help it, like, build up its roots and start to really establish. And if you can get it in the ground within 3 years, you can probably get a pretty good crop off of it pretty quickly. I've seen people growing currants in containers just forever. You don't get as good of a yield if it's in a container, but it's certainly doable for the long term as well.
Ah, there you go, Steve. Thanks for calling. Glenn in Middleton, what's on your mind?
Well, thank you. A couple things. First, I have drunk currant juice. It's the most wonderful juice I've ever tasted. It's just tremendous. So I could recommend that to people. I don't know how much you got to pick in order to get a glass of juice, but it was bought at the store and it was delicious. And then before I forget about butternut, I'm the emeritus professor of tree and forest health at UW. And butternut, I cannot recommend people to plant because it is subject to a lethal disease that has just about eliminated them from the wild. It's called butternut canker caused by a fungus. It got to the point that it was hard for me to even find butternuts to show them to students and show them the disease. Every time we'd find the butternuts, we'd find the disease. Sadly, Wisconsin used to have more butternut than any other state in the country, and they're just about gone. So anyway,
well,
and then, I have a comment about white pine blister rust because my major professor at UW-Madison spent his whole career working on white pine blister rust. It is not gone. It is a lethal disease of white pine. We're fortunate in that white pine is kind of rebounding in terms of natural regeneration. But if you have white pine, want to grow white pine, you do not want to have ribes, any of the ribes species that are native in Wisconsin, which there's 10 or 12 at least. They're not compatible with production of white pine. And I've even dealt with a small landowner who wondered why their white pines were dying, sent me a sample, and they had lined their driveways with ribes plants. And the blister rust is ubiquitous. It's even on ribes on the UW-Madison campus. So you really have to make your choice. Anybody who wants to grow white pine or grow white pine commercially or residentially, you do not want to have any of our ribes nearby. Now, the obvious goal would be to have resistance both within our native white pine or resistance within the ribes. But as far as I know, we do not have durable resistance in either yet.
Yeah, we have in black currants, there are resistant black currants to white pine blister rust. I don't like to say immunity because the white pine blister rust and the currant are both biological organisms and the fungus can adapt and figure out how to overcome our immunity. But there are a number of black currant varieties that don't seem to get it as much, though that's going to depend on the fungal strain. So like Savannah Zing and Savannah Zap are both resistant. They have a gene called the CR gene that seems to inhibit the spores being developed. I know you could also treat with mineral oil to keep spores from spreading, but yeah, the spores can really travel for thousands of feet in one direction and for hundreds of miles in the other direction, depending on what organism it's going from and going to.
Yeah. Glenn, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Johnny in Wausau has a different kind of thing going on here, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Johnny.
Hello. several years ago, over 40 years ago, my husband and I toured the International Peace Gardens in North Dakota in the spring, and I saw a bush that had the most beautiful fragrance and found out that it was a cinnamon currant. And so a few years after that, my husband found a nursery online where we could buy some cinnamon currants, and we have a beautiful cinnamon currant patch in our backyard. And I harvest the berries and dry them and make them in sweet breads, especially hot cross buns. They're terrific. About 5-6 years ago, we had really old potentilla bushes that we dug out. And so we divided the cinnamon currants and transplanted some stalks. My problem is that those stalks are still spindly. They will grow leaves, but I don't get much blossoms, and they haven't spread, and I don't get fruit.
Could be a lot of reasons for that, I suppose, Lily.
Yeah, there could be a couple of different reasons. The one that comes to my mind the most is fertilizing. Do you know how you're fertilizing those bushes?
No, we are not.
Okay. I know for, at least in my bushes, when I'm not getting flowers and fruit, it's because I'm under fertilizing.
So are you talking phosphorus? Are you talking nitrogen? Or are you
mostly nitrogen? Yeah, they're at least in Ribes nigrum. I'm not sure what cinnamon currant is in terms of the species name. Is it Lacustre or Aurum? I'm not sure. But in nigrum itself, you want like 100 pounds of nitrogen per acre if you're talking a farmer's field. So it wants a pretty heavy dosage of nitrogen. We're doing a fertilization trial right now in Ribes nigrum and black currant to see how much actually it needs, but that's the current recommendation, is 100 pounds per acre.
There you go, Johnny. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller with Jacob Grace and Lily Hislop for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along today here on WPR News as we talk about the latest on growing perennial foods with our two guests from the Savannah Institute, Jacob Grace and Lily Hislop. Great to have them along. And again, join in with your own thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. You know, before time gets away from us and I forget about it, I know you have an event coming up in March that I did want to have you talk about. It's the Perennial Farm Gathering, March 11th yes. through the 12th.
Yes, 11th through 13th, actually.
Oh.
But yeah, no, thanks for bringing this up. So we talked about a lot of different perennial crops today, and there are a lot of people growing these perennial crops all across the Midwest, but sometimes it's hard for them to find each other. So our Perennial Farm Gathering is a chance for people who are working with these crops to get together and share what they've learned. So our next Perennial Farm Gathering, like you said, is going to be March 11th through 13th. It's going to be in Dubuque, Iowa, so just over the river in Iowa. And our keynote speaker is going to be an Iowa farmer named Wendy Johnson, who is grew up on a family farm in Iowa and is doing a lot of different stuff on our farm with agroforestry and also with managed grazing and also with growing perennial grains. So those are all good examples of perennial agriculture and different ways that people can kind of get roots in the ground and improve their soil health. And then we're also going to be doing a book release event with an author named Liz Carlisle, who has edited a new collection of essays that's going to be coming out. It's called Living Roots, and it's writing by a bunch of different people across the country who are doing perennial agriculture, growing these crops, doing research. So we're going to be kind of kicking that off at the Perennial Farm Gathering. And if people want to learn more, they can go to the Savannah Institute website, which is savannahinstitute.org. And that's Savannah with no H. So hopefully you can find us there.
Okay. And it's cost. People need to sign up for it, I assume.
Yeah. You'll need to register in advance, but you can find all those details online.
And you mentioned earlier a podcast you guys are doing. Tell me some more about that podcast.
Yeah, so that's kind of my pet project is I like to have people on our podcast to just talk about things relating to agroforestry and perennial agriculture. So Lily's been on the podcast to talk about black currants. We have our most recent episode is talking to two researchers from UW-Madison about silvopasture by subtraction, which is something that people might be interested in. So this is if you have a poor quality woodland or a forest that needs some attention. Silvopasture by subtraction is kind of thinning that woodland and then adding pasture grasses or forages underneath so that it can be a place where you can have livestock and then also have trees overhead that can be used for timber or other purposes. So this kind of gets back to what I was saying is that there are a lot of different examples of agroforestry. It can look a lot of different ways. And we get into that in the podcast. So if people want to look into that more, they can look for the Savannah Institute podcast.
Savannah Institute podcast. Okay. Well, elderberries came up. I was going to ask you about elderberries earlier, Lily, but you're doing some work on elderberries as well.
Yeah. So the elderberry is a native bush crop to North America as well, Sambucus canadensis. And we're trying to develop varieties that are easier to harvest, that ripen around the same time, as opposed to, you know, ripening indeterminately across the entire bush, that stay on the bush until they're ready to harvest, things like that. Elderberries are interesting and delicious and healthful. I don't generally recommend that people eat them raw. I recommend that people process them into syrups or use heat on them to make sure that they have cyanogenic glucosides in them, which is like the same thing that's in apple seeds and why you're not supposed to eat a bunch of apple seeds. There's different levels, and the American version has less than the European version, and the ripe fruit has less than the roots, for example, but I still recommend people process it. And the vast majority of the elderberry cultivars that you can buy at nurseries are wild selections that people found in the woods or on their homesteads and went, this is great. We'll clone this and make this into a crop. And so I'm trying to do just generally the first layer of breeding of, I like this bush. It has big berries. I like this bush. It ripens all at the same time. Let's cross them together and see what we get.
That's cool. How long does it take for that whole process to work? I mean, you're not talking about 2 weeks later.
It's about 15 years to go from the first cross to a released product. It's a long time.
You're going to be a middle-aged woman by the time you get to talk about some of your results, although I imagine that you've got things going on all the time that you can...
Yeah, absolutely. The like black currant cultivars that we have through the Savannah Institute, we actually acquired a breeding program that had been going on for 20 years. A breeder named Richard McGinnis in British Columbia was looking to retire, and we were looking to start a breeding program. So that worked out really well. But because there hasn't really been much breeding done in elderberries, it's kind of me and Liz Pranger at Mizzou are kind of the two elderberry breeders that I know of in the United States. And I'm the only black currant breeder that I know of in North America who's institutionally backed. I think I'm the only one in the Western Hemisphere.
And that reminds me, somebody emails in about where did you say again, they can buy the black currant plants?
If you're looking to buy more than 25 plants or you and your neighbors are going in together, Canopy Nursery is a great place for wholesale perennial agriculture plants. If you're looking to buy maybe two varieties, I personally really like One Green World or Rain Tree Nursery are both very good. They produce great quality plants, and they have a really wide variety, especially of black currants and elderberries and other similar perennial fruit crops.
Steve in Bayfield County has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi, I wanted to let you know about what we've been working on in Bayfield County. We've been partnering with UW Extension and a gentleman named Jason Fishbach, who's been doing a lot of research with, most recently, he's been working with a table grape that would be grown in northern Wisconsin, but also his big research project over the last few years has been hazelnuts. And hazelnuts are native to northern Wisconsin or in Bayfield County, and there's been some real promising work being done now with that in our county. So just wanted to let you know about that.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. I've interviewed Jason more than once, but comment on that?
Yeah. Jason? Yep. Go ahead, Lily.
Jason Fishbach is really a brilliant guy and a delight to work with. The Savannah Institute is collaborating with him with the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative. So we're trialing a bunch of different hazelnuts between Jason's work and Minnesota's work with our breeder, Scott Brainard, out in our farm at Spring Green.
Very, very cool. Had another email. How are you funded?
Oh, we are Jacob, you can take this one.
Sure. If you want details, we do have our version of an annual report, which we call our perennial report because we work in perennial agriculture. You can find all that on the website. But we're funded by a mix of public and private grants and then also through donations. So it really is a mix of sources, but a big chunk of it is through grants. And then because we are a nonprofit organization, we're also able to accept donations. And as for the details, I don't know as much about that, but that's the big picture.
That's the big picture. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lily,
it's really cool to be doing community supported research. My work is supported by things like sales of black currants, such as Savannah Zing and Savannah Zap, and individual donations. And I do a lot of work with local farmers doing participatory breeding, where I give them plants and let them evaluate them, because ultimately they're the people who are going to be working with whatever cultivars I produce. So their opinion matters just as much as mine. And it's really great to work with these farmers and get their support in that way.
Yeah. What's the future look like for the Savannah Institute? I mean, there's thinking about all cuts and this and that have gone on. I mean, are you feeling healthy yourself?
I think we're pretty fortunate, again, being a nonprofit organization, that we have kind of a diverse source of funding, so that if certain funding sources go away, we have others that we can lean on a little bit more. And we definitely feel for some of our partners who are feeling those cuts a little bit more directly, and that is impacting our work, that some of these collaborations are not moving as fast as they might have been at another time. But we still really care about what we're doing, and we have funders and donors who really care about what we're doing. So we're excited to keep it up. And as Lily has talked about, working with these crops is a long-term proposition. If you're going to be trying to breed and improve tree crops, that's, we're planting things now that are hopefully going to outlive us. So that's kind of something that I appreciate about our work, is that it gets me thinking out into the future and hoping for good things.
Well, you both have no shortage of enthusiasm, and I love that. I want to thank you both for being with us today. It was a great hour and a great chance to talk with you, and I'm sure we'll be getting updates down the line from you as well. Thanks, Lily. Thanks,
Jacob.
Thank
you so much, Larry.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
Jacob Grace and Lily Hislop are both with the Savannah Institute. It was fun learning about all the work going on with trees and food trees and with currants as well, especially black currants. Great to have them with us, and great to have you listening in today. On Monday, we're going to talk with the author of our latest book club book of the year. It's titled A Measured Thread. I just finished reading it, and I really like it. And I know you will, too. So tune in on Monday for that. And a big thanks to our whole team, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller.